Many of you have heard talks by me on the subject, so I didn't want to give an overview of null canonical gravity, as I have done a few times already to you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start with a little tiny bit of an overview, and then I'm going to talk about some work in project in progress that might interest you, about the holographic entropy bound, which is related to this and is in fact one of the motivations for working on null canonical gravity. Okay. So, because it's a work in progress, I won't have a very clear conclusion to that. But okay. So first of all, we'll start about the context of null canonical gravity theory, null canonical anything theory. So the idea is that we use null hypersurfaces as initial data hypersurfaces. We put initial data on null hypersurfaces, and actually we're not going to consider arbitrary null hypersurfaces, but a specific kind, which I will call double null sheets. Okay. So these are made of two null hypersurfaces that intersect on a two surface S0 in spacetime. So this is a diagram in how this would look in a 2+1 dimensional spacetime, with drawn a bit curved to suggest that this is a construction that exists in curved spacetime as well. Another way of seeing it is that you have a two-dimensional, well, in 4+1 spacetime, it's two-dimensional. In 3+1 spacetime, it's a two-dimensional surface. In 2+1 spacetime, it's just a line, as is drawn here. But you have this space-like two-surface, and out of this two-surface, there are two sets of null normals emerging, one for each side, and you build the geodesics that are generated by the future null normals, and you follow those along for a while. So these hypersurfaces here are swept out by these geodesics, which are null and normal to S0. And those geodesics are called the generators of the hypersurfaces. Here's another diagram of this sort of hypersurface, but I'm trying to draw here the case of a three-dimensional hypersurface, which would live in 3+1 spacetime, but it's not embedded so as to be able to draw it well. Okay, so it's each of these here, these two branches, is a cylinder, and the two surface in the middle of the intersection is a disk. Okay, so, so if we put some initial data on this hypersurface, that determines the field, whatever field it may be, it could be the gravitational field, in a region, in a space-time region called the domain of dependence. And here I've drawn how it looks in Minkowski space. Okay, so these initial data are initial data for the field in the space-time region. It's it's necessary to work with a finite or compact hypersurfaces, because these generators eventually will form caustics. and they will actually enter into their own future domain of influence. And so it would stop being an acronal hypersurface if we follow them through the caustics. So we cut them off, we cut these hypersurfaces off before any of the generators can form a caustic or can cross.
Is it important to you that it be smooth everywhere? Because
yeah.
Otherwise, you could just, go beyond the caustic. I mean, you could just keep the boundary of the future.
Right.
It's smooth almost everywhere.
Right. I would cut it off exactly at the caustic, and then I would have a non-smooth thing. But yeah, I don't know if it can't be. The framework can't be extended to the case when it's not smooth. But I just said by fiat, we cut it off before any caustic is reached or any crossing. Okay. So some general advantages of doing this. One is that it's relatively easy to identify a free and complete data set, as data that are free of constraints and which can reproduce all solutions in this domain of dependence. The framework is intrinsically Lorentzian, so you don't have to, well, this is an issue in quantum theory, you don't have to do any wick rotation to get back to the Lorentzian world. Well, some other things, the observables, well, the main initial data, or all of the initial data, really have a fairly direct interpretation, so that might help in defining observables. And there's a natural, although not especially easy to handle, notion of time evolution in this framework. And that's that you just slide one of these hypersurfaces up along the other one. You take cross sections of one of these hypersurfaces and sweep out new, well, for every cross section of SL, you sweep out a new SR, and so this can evolve into the future in a preferred way. Well, those are nice, but the real reason that this interested me originally and still is that is this holographic entropy conjecture of, a number of people, Bekenstein, Tuft, Suskind, and finally formalized by Busso, okay? And, I don't know if it makes sense. Well, I'll tell you in 2 seconds what it is, just in case this is something somebody doesn't know. So you go precisely to this sort of context. I wish I didn't have this little thing here, but this is one of this pair of null hypersurfaces. And you just concentrate on one of them, one branch, SR, let's say. And you put in a requirement here that the generators at their origin on this two-dimensional two-surface, space-like two-surface, are not diverging. So they don't start out diverging. Okay? So you make these conditions, and then in Busso's version of this bound, the claim is that the entropy defines some of the field on or the world on this branch NR is less than or equal to the area of this cross section here from which it starts, and divided by 4 times the Planck area. Okay, so the black hole entropy formula. Okay. Now, it's not, here we're in a sort of motivational phase of things, so it's not totally clear what you mean by the entropy on this hypersurface, but you'd like to define it somehow in analogy to the way you can define the entropy of a system on a space-like hypersurface. And in some cases, you can, in fact, define this entropy. So, okay, so if the entropy satisfies this this bound, then that suggests that if there's the field has a Hilbert space associated with this branch only, then the dimensionality of this Hilbert space ought to be equal or less than the exponential of this entropy. The argument you can make, I mean, obviously going in the other direction is fairly easy because this is taking the logarithm of the dimensionality of the Hilbert space is just giving you the microcanonical estimate of the entropy. But going in the other way, you can also argue that in most thermodynamic systems, the macro state with the most entropy, in fact, has almost all of the microstates. So then, if that macro state has this entropy, then the dimensionality of this Hilbert subspace that corresponds to that macro state would be this exponential of this entropy. And if that has almost all of the microstates that there are in the whole system, then that's the same as the essentially the same as the dimensionality of the whole Hilbert space. Well, okay, and you might worry, well, what do you mean by the Hilbert space associated with just one branch? It's rather an odd notion. One branch has no domain of dependence, so it's the Hilbert space of what? So that could be something that you could define. It would be a Hilbert space of some initial data. The other thing you could do is say, well, I'm going to suppose that both of these sheets satisfy Boussot's condition that the generators are not expanding, are not diverging at the intersection surface. That's in fact a condition you can impose on both sides. In flat space, it's a little bit hard to imagine, but no, you can do it in flat space too. You can just imagine, for instance, that these sheets are pieces of two past null cones, and the intersection at the intersection of these two past null cones, you have this two-dimensional surface, and there certainly you would have the generators coming out from both sides converging, even though you don't need to be inside of a black hole. Okay, so you impose that on both sides, and then taking this suggestion, or going straight from here, you would get that the dimensionality of the Hilbert space associated with the whole hypersurface would be less than or equal to the exponential of the area of S0 over 2 times the Planck area. Well, that seems to be Hilbert space. That makes more sense. There's a domain of dependence. Classically, there's a phase space. So you could imagine that there's a Hilbert space. Okay. So this is a fairly developed, reasonably well-developed classical theory of general relativity in terms of free initial data on these hypersurfaces. And just to, so you don't believe I'm lying to you, I put all of the Poisson brackets of a free set of initial data here. Okay, I don't expect you to assimilate more than 50% of this, while I show it to you. The point is just that they're a bit complicated, but they're still not so complicated that you can't fit them onto one page. Okay, but really this is not what we're going to talk about. It's just that's an important part of the program that exists. We're going to now go back to this motivation of the holographic entropy bound and see if what more we can say about that. Okay, so that was a general introduction to a null gravity with canonical gravity, free non-initial data, and now we're going to go to this work in progress about the entropy bound. Okay, so.
Can you just say what the data actually is? Is it simple enough to say that?
Well, the main data, the main data is, well, you could take it to be the shear of the congruence, or you can take it to be the, if you take a space-like cross-section, well, any cross-section actually space-like of the, one of these branches of this null hypersurface, then on this cross-section there's a metric. You take this metric and you divide it by the area density, so you get this conformally invariant thing. And you evaluate the metric in a set of coordinates that are carried along from the initial two surface along the generators, the convected along the generators. So this metric really tells you how, in a metric sense, the cross sections of the congruence of generators is being squeezed and stretched. Another way of saying it, you could imagine putting a slide of your favorite person at S0, illuminating it for an instant, and then these generators trace out in a sort of a ray optics way where the light from each of the points on the slide go, and the data is how the person is being distorted by the gravitational field. That's the main data. Then there's some data on S0, there's the area density there, and some more stuff that's more difficult to describe.
So it's basically just the metric induced on the null sheet.
Yeah.
Is the data.
Right, you could, of course, start with the whole metric, but then you have constraints. So this is a set of free data where you've already whittled away everything that's fixed by constraints.
But is there any constraint on how this cross-sectional metric varies?
No.
So isn't that just the same as giving a metric?
It's a cross-sectional metric divided by the area density.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a conformal structure of the cross. Okay, so here actually I should draw a picture. Okay, so let's try to understand why the Hilbert space of a scalar field interacting semi-classically with gravity should satisfy a holographic bound on its dimensionality. I mean, it's rather strange. Normally, the Hilbert space of a scalar field is infinite dimensional, so it's even strange that it should be finite. And so one way, a simple picture you can draw, which I will draw now, is the following. Suppose you have one, let's just consider one branch of this null. Well, one null hypersurface, one branch of this double null sheet, making it rather small there, like it's almost reaching the caustic. Okay, and through this branch, on this surface are registered various excitations of your field. We're going to consider, okay, to make things simpler, yeah, okay, I already said we're considering a scalar field instead of all of general relativity and a scalar field. Okay, so here we have some quanta that are impinging on this null hypersurface. Okay, and these quanta, I've just drawn a few, they're represented by produce a stress tensor or sort of a null energy density here. And that makes the generators focus. Okay. So now, suppose we have one here right at the end. And now we're going to try to stuff another one of these quanta through this null hypersurface. And what does that do? Well, it makes the generators from here on start to focus more. And so when I should draw it again in another picture. So here's the extra quantum. Here are the others. And well, let's see if I drew it as I wanted to. So they focus more, and the idea is that then this last quantum that was just at the tip falls off. Okay? And so if we had here four quanta, we still have four quanta. Yeah?
But so you're assuming something also about what's going on outside the surface, right? Because I can also send another quanta that goes just by it on one side. And it will defocus on this side, right? So it pulls on the null rays on this side. I will make my surface larger. You see what I'm saying?
How can you make the surface larger?
So I started with these, and I'm sending the null rays sort of this way. So I have some focus in here, and they come in, and they merge, they cross here. But if I also had some focusing power here, so the curvature, if I'm not controlling the curvature here, that this rays that we're converging on this side will start moving in the opposite direction.
No, adding matter always always causes more focusing.
Right, but I'm that's true, but it's putting it beyond the point.
Oh, you mean diverting it to another place.
That's right.
Yeah, okay, so this is what I call a simple picture. So all of these, what you're saying is quite true, and you can make several other arguments against this picture that makes you doubt that it's really true. But indulge me a little bit, and let me say one more thing about this, and then we'll go to a somewhat better picture. Okay. So another thing that's interesting, another thing one could say, steer away. Is that if you could somehow show that the Hilbert space associated with one of these hypersurfaces is finite dimensional, then you can argue, again at this very hand-wavy level, that the entropy should really be extensive in the area. That the argument is something like this. Okay. Suppose you have two of these hypersurfaces and you glue them together, two equal ones, and you glue them together to make one bigger one. Then, since any point here is space-like to any point here, somehow it seems that they're not causally related systems, so it seems reasonable to suppose that if the Hilbert space of one of these guys has dimension equal to n, then the dimension of the Hilbert space of n, well, let's call it, of the two glued together should be n squared, should be there. And well, so this has twice the area and for S0 And it has twice the exponential here. So when you take the logarithm, well, the logarithm of the dimensionality would seem to be extensive in the area. Okay, well, those are just ideas to keep in mind. You have to motivate things to then try to demonstrate them. Okay, so here's a somewhat better picture than this one, which is phrased entirely in terms of initial data on N. Actually, in terms of initial data on one branch to begin with. Suppose that theta is the expansion of the congruence of the generators, and lambda an affine parameter. Then you have the Rayshad-Hurey equation, well, actually, the Einstein equation combined with the Rayshad-Hurey equation, which tells you how this expansion evolves. Okay? Everybody knows what the expansion is? Rate of divergence of the generators. Okay, so in this argument, we'll ignore the shear because the shear term, which is this sigma squared here, because that just would make the argument stronger because it just makes focusing happen faster. So we'll just leave that out. And we will also, to make things simple, that's not so well motivated, but to make things simple, we'll suppose that this stress, this null energy density component of the stress tensor has a uniform value tau on the whole branch. And also we'll suppose here in these equations that that the expansion of the generators is in fact zero at S0. It could be negative and would be within Busso's rules, but we'll say it's zero. And we'll also set the affine parameter zero at S0. Okay, well, in that case, you can solve this equation and you find that the expansion is simply a tangent with some coefficients. It's a root of 4 pi g times the energy density outside of the tangent and also inside. Well, as we all know, the tangent blows up at pi over 2. And so there's this congruence will, in fact, form a caustic at a certain value of lambda maximum of this value. And here is the key to getting a bound. The value of our, and it's rather similar to what's happening here, the value of the affine parameter where we cut off the generators has to be less than this lambda max. Okay? It's really the same thing happening. Okay, well, so now let's suppose that this, now we want to know something about this tau. Supposing we have, first of all, simply one mode of the scalar field on NR, which is excited with one quantum. Okay, so the four momentum, or the covector four momentum of this particle would be h bar ka. And at the same time, it would be PA, this would be equal to the expectation value of A lambda of the component A lambda of the stress tensor. The component lambda is the component along the generator with, well, really along the vector D by D lambda. Okay? And so it would be this energy density multiplied by lambda bar, which is the length in units of our affine parameter of the sheet, and multiplied by the area of the cross initial cross section of this branch, multiplied by some factor that takes into account that the area, cross-sectional area of the branch is actually getting small as you go up. So that's some number less than 1. F is number less than 1. And so then you get that tau, which is the expectation value of T lambda lambda, is, HK lambda divided by, this coefficient here, and that in turn is larger than, it's larger than, here I've taken F, which is less than 1 out, so that already makes it smaller, so it has to be larger than this evaluated with F equal 1. And then I replaced K lambda by 2 pi times an integer divided by lambda bar. That's just supposing, since it's a mode, somehow the field on this sheet, that the mode has an integer number, m, of wavelengths between S0 and the end of this sheet. Okay? So I get this inequality. And so now I impose this. I had an expression for lambda max, and I haven't, and that had tau in it, and then I got an expression for tau, and I will impose that lambda bar, which also appeared in that expression for tau, lambda bar, which is the maximum value of lambda on the sheet, is less than lambda maximum, so that there's no caustic form. And that, when you work it out, translates to M has to be less than the area of S0 divided by 32 times the Planck area. Okay? And then you can do the same sort of reasoning for various modes, each occupied by n quanta. And you get that the sum over m multiplied by the number of quanta in the mode m has to be less than this limit. OK, so that's encouraging, although it's still far from a rigorous, even still rather hand-waving. But it seems to be going in the right direction. You're limiting the number of modes and you're allowing and how much they're occupied. And if you apply the same reasoning to the other branch, and also another condition you have to put, and that is that in a certain sense, the whole pair of branches is larger than Planck scale. That is lambda. there's the statement. I choose affine parameters so that one way of saying it, if I choose affine parameters so that the inner product of the tangent vectors of the of the generators at S0 is 1, then the product of the values of these affine parameters at the endpoints has to be larger than the Planck area. So if you do that, then you find that only a finite subset of the Fock basis is allowed. Okay. So that looks holographic.
What is the justification for this?
Well, certainly if your hypersurface is smaller than the Planck scale, this sort of semi-classical reasoning doesn't have any.
But what does it mean? Lambda.
How do you mean what it means? You're saying, in a sense, you're saying that the size of the. I don't know at what level you're asking the question. So suppose we were in flat space, we could imagine taking a vector from S0 to the end of the generator, another vector from S0 to the end of the other generator. And I'm saying that the area spanned by this vector is larger than the Planck area. it's a Lorentz invariant way of saying that it's not sub-Planckian size initial data surface.
Is it, if you just apply it to the one branch, you say you don't get any definite, I mean, you wrote an inequality there. You say
yeah.
You can't convert this into.
But here, there's nothing telling you that you couldn't have an infinite number of modes. Let's see, what am I saying? So you can, all these modes are, the modes aren't defined by M, then M only. They can also have transverse momentum. Right? And as long as what's going on at the other branch isn't limited, this transverse momentum can have any value. So for any given M, there's an infinity of modes, and I can take my few quanta that I'm allowed to excite and put them in an infinite number of possible modes. And so it would still be infinite dimensional. But if I have the sort of bound on the other side, then I have basically a bound on the momentum, on the two null momentum components. And that also gives me a bound on the transverse momentum, just because it's well, subluminal or luminal at most, and that then combined with this other limit gives you a bound. Okay, so how am I doing for time? Okay. Okay, so that'd be perfect. Okay, so this is nice, but and it probably can be improved quite a bit. But of course, one would really like to do better and really work with a proper field theory of the scalar field, and see what can be said there, and not. Playing around modes defined by hand. Okay, so now I'm going to briefly review some very simple things about Fock quantization of a free scalar field in curved spacetime. Not so long ago, they were new to me, so I will tell them to you, even maybe not new to all of you. Okay, so this is, first of all, we start with the completely familiar stuff. So the standard procedure for quantizing a Fock quantization of a free field is the following. Well, you recognize that it's a linear system, so it's natural to choose linear canonical coordinates, you can call Q, I, and Pi, and you quantize by requiring that these particular linear canonical coordinates satisfy the canonical commutation relations exactly. Okay. Equivalently, you can make complex combinations of these canonical coordinates or the corresponding operators and require that these satisfy this other version of the canonical commutation algebra of the creation and annihilation operators. Then you define a representation of this algebra by, well, you requiring that there's a state, only one state, which is annihilated by all of these annihilation operators, and then that the rest of the Hilbert space is simply the span of the vectors obtained by acting on this vacuum vector zero with a finite number of the A daggers. Okay, so this is all very familiar. Now, there's an important point. You don't actually need a particular linear canonical coordinate system in order to define a particular Fock space. Okay? These canonical coordinates define a metric on the phase space which make these canonical coordinates orthonormal. Okay, the metric is simply the Pythagoras formula adding squares of these coordinates. Okay, and this metric and the symplectic 2 form completely define the Fock quantization. Well, modulo changes of orthonormal basis within each n particle level. Okay, so the basic elements for a Fock quantization are, well, the symplectic 2 form, which the classical theory gives you, and this metric, which you've got to add. Okay, so is there a way to get rid of this little thing at the bottom?
Move the mouse away. Just move it somewhere else. It should disappear at some point.
Okay. At some point. Ah, great. Okay. Okay, so here's a proposal for a quantization that you could make of null initial data according to these rules. Okay. So first you use the standard flat space-time quantization of the Klein-Gordon field in Minkowski space to quantize the initial data on a pair of intersecting null hyperplanes. Well, it's a sort of a double null sheet, but a special one. It you take the standard null coordinates, which consist of an x plus, which is the time, plus the preferred direction in space, z, let's say, or x1 here, and x minus is the time minus this preferred x, and then you have two transverse coordinates also. And these, this hypersurface consists of the union of two null hyperplanes, the x minus equals zero plane, but only allowing x plus positive, and x plus equals zero plane only allowing x minus positive. But in any case, this is an infinitely big double null sheet, so I'm actually cheating. I'm not. It's not compact anymore. Okay. And it's they're hyperplanes. They're not just null surfaces. Okay. Now, so this can be done. And now, what you do is you import this quantization to curved spacetime. So the reason you can, the way you do this is as follows. First of all, I'll show you how you can, that the symplectic 2 form in the curved spacetime with our n here is closely related to the symplectic 2 form on this flat spacetime special double null sheet. Okay. Okay, so I'll just write down here for you the symplectic 2 form for the Klein-Gordon scalar on an arbitrary double null sheet in curved spacetime. And it's the sum over the two branches. And on each branch, you take the integral of one of the fields, phi 2, differential of phi 1 minus phi 1, differential of phi 2, wedge with the area form on the cross section on cross sections of the null sheet. Okay? And reducing this to a coordinate expression, you put some coordinates x perp on the intersection 2 surface as 0. And you have another coordinate s that parameterizes the generators. And then you can write this as phi 2 derivative along s of phi 1 minus phi 1 derivative along s of phi 2 times the area density in these coordinates x perp at the constant s cross section. Okay. So now, because this is anti-symmetric in 1 and 2, it turns out I can absorb this rho here, this area density, in a redefinition of the fields. I simply take the phis and I multiply each one by square root of rho, and I have a new phi. And so the formula for the symplectic 2 form is just the same, but there's no rho appearing here. And this is just a formula that you have in this flat N in Minkowski space. Okay. So what you do is you take X perp to be to range over the same range of values, well, all of R2 in that it has in Minkowski space, and you take ds to range over all positive reals. Okay, and then you really have an expression that's identical to the expression in for this special double null sheet in Minkowski space. It also will be important that that you take S to be a fixed function of rho. Rho changes monotonically, so you can choose it so that it's invertible, and then rho is a fixed function of S, fixed once and for all by some convention, and it doesn't depend on the field configuration, on the gravitational field. Okay, so you've done that. So there's this very simple relation between the flat space special double null sheet symplectic 2 form and the general one. And you can, in fact, also import the metric by the same formula. And this turns out to be a metric compatible with the symplectic, well, I should put an N here, with the symplectic 2 form. The fact that the metric comes is a metric that makes some canonical coordinates, orthonormal, can be written as a compatibility condition between the symplectic 2 form and the metric. If you look in Wald's book on quantum field theory in curved space-time, he talks a lot about that compatibility condition, which is not very complicated, but somehow ungainly. But anyway, if you define the metric by, again, the same sort of formula, you simply take the modified of the fields multiplied by root rho, and you use the metric from Minkowski space, the phase space metric, not the Minkowski metric, to define this metric, then you find, in fact, a metric compatible with the symplectic 2 form. So this actually defines a quantization.
So rho is what? It's the area density at the origin? What is rho?
Rho is the area density at the constant S cross section.
Which one? The origin? The one you started from?
If S is the value it has at the origin, then it's that. But rho is a function of S. And also of x perpendicular. It's a function on this null sheet. But it's the area density if you take a constant S cross section. Then it take a constant S cross section. The x perp coordinates, the perpendicular coordinates, are transported along the generators. That is, each generator has a fixed value of these x perpendicular. And so they define coordinates also on this constant S cross section, and rho is the area density there.
Is your notation that the bare phi or the curly phi is just defined at the original cross section and the...
No, the curly phi is a Minkowski space field.
Oh, that's the Minkowski. So why is it, it says G sub n of phi 1 phi 2 equals G sub n of phi 1 phi 2.
This is supposed to be another n. This is the square n.
Yeah, I see that it's a square n, but What is that square n? That just means the Minkowski space?
The square n is the is this double null sheet in Minkowski space, this infinite double null sheet.
The curly one is the same thing in the curved space?
No, it's not infinite, it's just a finite thing.
Right.
Okay, so you, yeah?
So this choice of G, that's basically a choice of vacuum of your theory? Is
that yeah.
So basically what you're doing here is you're importing the vacuum from flat Minkowski space into some curved space.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay, so you've done this and you're very happy, you have a quantization, but it has exactly the same Hilbert space as the flat space-time theory. Okay? No matter how the scalar field affects the geometry, there's no holography, there's no limitation whatsoever on the states. So...
But you haven't told us the back reaction in a proper way, right? Because you haven't said...
But the back reaction plays no role in the translation formula, because this rho is simply a fixed function of the coordinates.
Yeah, but how do you know you wouldn't have produced a state that would have had a... Their back reaction. How do you
well,
know
you produce
would,
the state,
how
but
do you know your vacuum would be compatible with the semi-classical Einstein equation?
Okay, then. Okay, so the idea is that this field does what it wants, and the gravitational field, well, it's whatever the gravitational field is that this scalar field produces. But there's nothing in this quantization procedure that allows the gravitational field to say to the scalar field that it's not allowed to do something.
No.
But that because the whole goes to zero.
You simply have all these states of Fock space, in Fock space, and each of them has some gravitational field associated.
Yeah, but S cannot go, S is not arbitrary now, because rho goes to zero at the acoustic, right?
Right, but
so you have to truncate in some way your space theory.
For instance, I can set, I've set rho to be a function of S. For instance, I could, set write rho as rho zero times v squared. Rho zero is the area density on the initial cross section of S zero. Sorry, this is very small. Write it bigger. And v squared is the ratio. I could, for instance, if I want to, I could use v as a coordinate. Right? So then it would run from 1 at S0, and I demand that it be bigger than 1 at the end, let's say 1 half. Okay? So then I could define my null hypersurface by simply the range of Vs from 1 to 1 half. Now, I actually want an S that ranges from 0 to infinity, but there's no difficulty in writing V as a function of S so that when S ranges from 0 infinity to infinity, V ranges from 1 to 1 half. So it would just be another parameterization where, yet again, rho is simply a function of the...
Wait, I don't understand that. The rho of S is fixed, no? It's a specific function. And then isn't there a point where rho of S prime is equal is the acoustic, so you can't control that?
Yeah, but...
So it means that your integration for S has to be truncated. No?
No, because I can.
Then I don't understand what is S.
The hypersurface is always avoiding the caustic. The caustic comes sooner, then the hypersurface is shorter.
Yeah,
but I put whatever coordinates I want on this hypersurface. So I can set up the coordinates, and I mean, there's a specific scheme here. I can set up the coordinates so that they set always run over the same range, even though the hypersurface is getting smaller.
I'm sorry, you have a ds in your formula, so you cannot have a function. You cannot change that by a function of s. Can you?
A ds.
Before. You're saying this formula is invariant under.
Yeah, but that, but just precisely because rho is some function of S, so the reason you can absorb it is that, so here you have hidden inside some root rho's. So you would have, when you expand this derivative, you would have root rho phi 2 times the derivative of root rho times phi 1. So there would be a contribution root rho ds root rho phi 1 times phi 2. But there's the same contribution here, and it cancels. The anti-symmetry allows
you
to...
So you're saying that in flat space, if you do the quantization along a finite strip or infinite strip, then this is the same thing. So the dimension of Dilbert space and the number of states, they're just an isomorphism between these stuff. And if I take my strip to be infinitely small, it's the same thing as taking it.
Well, in a way I am saying that. But if you're going to say that's wrong, then I also agree with you. Okay? So there's... Okay, so I already said that. So what's wrong with this quantization? Okay. And if there are several quantizations, how do I know which one is the good one? I can choose all these different metrics. I know that in curved space-time, in field theory, in fact, in field theory, these different metrics are not... do not give equivalent, unitarily equivalent quantizations. In, if you just quantize an ordinary harmonic oscillator, all of this comes up again. The different metrics correspond to different squeezed vacua, and they're all equivalent. All the quantizations are all unitarily equivalent, but that's not the case in field theory. Okay? Another question that comes up, well, the idea was somehow that the expectation value of the stress tensor causes focusing, and this somehow would limit the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. But is the expectation value of the stress tensor even defined in this case? I mean, in this other calculation, I suppose that the stress tensor was uniform and things like that, and in a quantum, in a serious field theory version of that calculation, I would, of course, want to calculate the expectation value of the stress tensor or of this component, the null energy density, as a function of position on n and do things correctly. So is it even defined? Well, so all these questions are answered by the same thing. It's called the microlocal spectral condition. So here's what the microlocal spectral condition is. How many people know already? Know? Okay, a few. Okay, so I'm not boring you all. So in Minkowski space field theory, one demands that the energy of all states be positive, or more generally, you require that the expectation value of the four momentum vector lie in the future light. But in curved space-time, there's no natural Fourier transform to define this or translation symmetry, if you like, to define this momentum vector, total momentum vector. But still, by the equivalence principle, you would expect that field theory in curved space-time locally is like field theory in flat space-time. So this principle should apply at least locally to very high-frequency modes. And so the microlocal spectral condition is a precise statement of that idea. What you do is you take one version of the microlocal spectral condition is you take the distribution, which is the field operator acting on the vacuum, it's a distribution in space-time, you multiply it by a, you don't integrate it against, you multiply it by a test function with a compact support, So it's a, it becomes a local thing, localized. And then you take your Fourier transform in your favorite coordinate systems of this object. And then you look at this Fourier transform, and you imagine plugging in a momentum times a parameter eta. And the microlocal spectral condition requires that the Fourier transform falls off more rapidly than any inverse power of eta as eta goes to infinity, except if k, this momentum, lies on the past light cone. That lies on the past light cone after various signs involved translates into the actual energy or momentum being in the future light cone. Okay. So this is a very natural condition. And it's also a very powerful condition. Radzikovsky, I think this was 96, or maybe it was 95, I'm not sure, showed that the microlocal spectral condition is equivalent to requiring that the vacuum state is Hadamard, which is an adjective that describes a class of nice vacuum states. And now with this equivalence principle motivation, even more compelling. These have following properties. The expectation values of the whole stress tensor is well defined on a dense subspace of a Fock space if the vacuum is Hadamard. And Ferhi also showed in 94 that if you just have at your disposal observables built out of the fields in an open space-time region with compact closure, then you can't distinguish the quantum theories with different Hadamard vacua. So there isn't just one Hadamard vacuum, but they're all in some in a local sense, they're all equivalent. So there is sort of a consensus, I think, at least among the people I've read, that Hadamard vacua are the good vacua. Well, there are actually some extensions of Hadamard that are maybe also good. But they share the same properties. Okay. So, well, is the vacuum defined by RG and Hadamard? Well, almost, but not quite. What conclude? So we didn't actually have a counterexample to holography. And the obvious conjecture is that holography follows as a consequence of the microlocal spectral condition. I think if it doesn't follow as a consequence, given that that the Hadamard vacuum, or the class of Hadamard vacua, basically defines locally defines the quantum theory. If it's not a consequence of the microlocal spectral condition, then holography is very dubious. At this sense of holography. Okay, well that's
I just want to understand what your conjecture says. It says that it follows as a result of that plus the semi-classical Einstein equation. Is that the conjecture, or is it decoupled from
the... Sure.
And then involved in that, there's a prescription for renormalizing the stress energy tensor.
Right.
And so you'll be using some point splitting or some...
Sure.
Is that...
Yeah, so there's a... With the Hadamard condition, there is a well-defined prescription. It's true. I don't know if it's the only possible way of doing it. Somehow, well, you can put some axioms, what you think are desirable properties, and then it's uniquely defined for Hadamard. The renormalized
I'm just wondering if you really need this microlocal condition. if you didn't satisfy that, but you used the same prescription for renormalizing the stress tensor, you'd probably find an infinite energy density, and the back reaction would be huge, and the slide sheet would just disappear, or something like that.
I guess.
But maybe that's just that microlocal is just a consistency. Could it be viewed as just a consistency condition for your choice of renormalization procedure for the stress energy tensor?
I really don't know. I really don't understand anything about what happens with a stress energy tensor when you don't put the Hadamard or the microlocal spectral condition. It's just somehow, well, the world ends there.
Well, naively you get an infinite energy density, because what that condition means is that in some sense you don't have the very high frequency modes are not excited.
Right, of course, that's what happens.
And so if you fail that condition, then it says that the high frequency modes are excited.
Sure.
It might be a little bit, but enough in any case to build up an infinite energy density. So there's some at least intuitive sense in which going beyond Hadamard, but keeping the same renormalization procedure causes the renormalized stress energy tensor to be infinite.
Yeah, no, it could be. The sort of the attitude I've absorbed from the people I've read is that, how great, we have this Hadamard condition. Now we can do all these things that were not possible. And somehow, with this argument with the microlocal spectral conditions, argument from the equivalence principle, somehow you would say that that these non-Hadamard states are, well, really there's a more general class of states, but where you require a different form of this microlocal spectral condition that's a little bit more generous. But basically, again, it's one of these local versions of positive energy. And if you don't require that, then somehow you're doing something completely pathological that you would never do in flat space. But, you know, maybe it's good to do these things.
Well, I'm not saying you should.
Okay.
I have two questions. So the first one is, why do you expect, when you don't have gravity, why do you expect any form of holography?
I don't.
Oh, okay, so.
I mean, that was what all these arguments with these sort of arguments in the air, slightly hand-wavy or very hand-wavy.
So then I don't understand.
Holography as a consequence of back reaction.
So then I don't understand the second part of your talk. What are you trying to prove with the scalar field? Because as you say, here there's no, gravity is not dynamical, so why?
Well, it is dynamical, but it has no effect on the scalar field. Oh, it has no effect on the initial data on the null surface. The initial data does what it wants, and the gravity acts in consequence of that, but doesn't send any message back to this initial data.
Okay. So then the thing, the second question is, let's forget the curve case. The thing we discussed about the diffeomorphism is, in some sense, you're taking a finite linear wedge, right? Mm-hmm. So you take a portion of a plane, and then let's do a finite. So this is the case you're looking at, right? So you look at a portion of Minkowski spacetime, which mm-hmm. is just a finite, you know, some kind of truncation of a Lindau wedge by two half non-coordinate.
Okay.
At the tip, right? That's your description. So now.
Wait, which one are you talking about? The N? The square N? The one I used as a. Or you're just talking about. Are you talking about the compact double null sheet or the non compact one?
I'm talking about the guy you get when you do your scalar field.
But the one I used in Minkowski space, or
yeah, let me do it in
Minkowski. That one in Minkowski space was not a finite wedge.
Yeah, but
we
just established that, you know. So your statement about the fact that you can reabsorb rho, you can have a statement purely in Minkowski space. So look at this Lindau wedge. So now your statement there is essentially, so now we have everything is under control because we do quantization of a Ringler. It's more, it's less than a Ringler wedge, right? It's a finite dimension, compact portion.
Well, that's okay. So my, what I was using was not a compact. It was the whole thing.
Let me take that because I can use on this Ringler wedge the same theorem as okay. So I take this Ringler wedge there. I, you know, make it finite there because your S0 is finite on the distance. Mm-hmm. You see the, I mean, that's how I understand your picture in flash. So you have a Ringler wedge like that. This is an outfold, and I need the other portion. Right? So that's your domain of the thing. Right? Mm-hmm. If I look like that, I get a Ringler wedge. If I look conversely,
that's not really a domain of dependence.
So what is it?
The domain of dependence, but maybe we shouldn't get into that. What is your central
point?
The
thing is that now your theorem about the fact that you can rescale these things would say that in this particular case, the quantization of scalar field in any of these Ringler wedge, so I can take this Ringler wedge and make any conformal transformation, right, which would kind of rescale these S coordinates.
Yeah.
And then you're saying the quantization of this guy has to be completely independent of this conformal rescaling. That's
right.
Essentially your statement. Whether it's finite or infinite would give
right.
Exactly,
so this is
the
quantization
statement.
With the only rules of the, where you're not making any sort of requirement of positive energy. So I hadn't imposed the microlocal spectral condition.
Yeah, but here you could establish clearly that something is wrong with that.
Sure.
At least if the field is massless, it might be subtle. The field is massive. You know, you know the theory breaks conform invariance. So you're just
okay, I thought of it another way. I could quantizing this way, I could argue that a free fields of different masses
Anyway.
Okay.
So
I would suggest maybe that since it's late, we just postpone the rest of the discussion to have some cake.
Okay.
And let's thank our speaker again.